Last December the 6th, this little note came around for the special interest group this quarter, and one of them said focus on city slums. Didn't know what was going to develop. I want to say this last one of our series, we're very pleased with what has developed. And a special word of thanks to the Social Concerns Committee of the seminary for their interest. And they have really pitched in and helped us plan week by week. And an extra special word of thanks to Paul Middlestadt and the other co-workers down at the ICUA, Interreligious Center for Urban Affairs. Thanks also to Jim Cross of our staff and the board for mission. You may not know it. He helped us underwrite what little experience we had for this series. You men might like to know we had a very distinguished series of men out here. That's Peter Saltzik and Charles Lieber and W.H. Schallacher, and Ross, Harold Lazarus, and Margaret Bush Wilson. And you men are the beginning climax of this series because they will tell a little bit how what these other authorities in the field of housing have been saying, how this ties up at least with a couple congregations. Both of these men are from the AME Church. I started out in the ministry in 1946 as a white pastor of a black congregation. In the first meeting of black clergy in our town, a couple of fellows introduced themselves as AME pastors, and I frankly didn't know what that was, but I pretended that I did. Later on, of course, I found out that they were very active in their community, as are these men here. I met Pastor Mayo at Urban Training Center in Chicago. I hadn't met him in St. Louis. I had to go to Chicago to meet my neighbor here, which is sometimes the case. I had done my field work just two blocks down the street from his church. Still didn't know him or his church. But there he told us about how his congregation, St. James AME, was going to start a new turnkey program, one of the first in the country, to do something about an old building, which old seven-story building across the street from his church. So we're glad to have you and see you again, Pastor Mayo. And Vinton Anderson, I first met down at the board meeting for ICUA, and he's at St. Paul's AME Church on the West End, and with a couple other churches of his denomination, is involved in a housing project in Elmwood Park. So I'm not going to tell you what they are, lest I steal any of your thunder. These men, like other clergymen in all denominations, including ours, have been trying to relate the church's interest and concern to housing problem of our country. So we're glad to have you with us. And then when you lead off first, we will save the elder statesman for the last time. All right. All right. And we'll give you each 15 to 20 minutes. Both of these men have got a big story to tell, and I hate to cut them short or limit them to that. But we'll try to save a little time for questions at the end. So, it's all yours, Ben. Pastor Ben Anderson of St. Paul AME Church.
You guys can sit there,
or you can stand or face, or.
I want to sit down. Okay. I should be saying enough about housing in the last 15 minutes because I'm not expert in housing at all. I believe that housing, of course, is one of the little crucial areas. I think all of us have discovered that it's a very crucial area in the urban crisis. We're involved in it not because we believe the church ought to be building houses. In fact, I don't think that building houses 221B3 or 10G or 221H1, I don't believe that this is really the business of the church necessarily. I think the church has the real job of stimulating and creating the kind of concern on the part of local institutions to do build. But if it happens that we cannot do the right kind of stimulation, if we aren't getting the right kind of response from people in the area of building houses, then I think the church has to sort of give the example, it has to give proof that it can be done. So we got involved because we felt that there was not enough stimulation in our community and not enough concern about building houses for low-income, moderate-income families. The popular program at the time we started out like that was the 221D3 program, and Pembroke number one, which is already completed, and I think it has been completed for about 2 years in Elmwood Park, was one of the first, if not the first, complete 221D3 program in the metropolitan area. It's a very small project, 50 units. 50-unit project really is not enough volume to be able to provide the kind of services and the kind of on-the-scene management which is necessary to give, I think, the tenants the best out of the project, nor is it sufficient income for us to properly manage it. And we've had several problems in program number two, We have a flat roof for one thing, and this is a construction problem where we found the water spilling over. We have problems by not having people on the job all the time in the care of the property. For instance, we're bothered that much about the tenants and the way the kids kick out the doors and the way the appearance of the building is in general. And we're trying to take a real hard look at problems that are there, and we might be able to correct them in trail number two. Trail number two is being built. I didn't mean to mention it there because trail two is sort of an actualization. You can go to Deer Road and see them. We're past three quarters finished in construction, that is, exterior construction. And we do hope that in about 2 or 3 weeks we will be able to put the first tenants in. Our schedule for opening the project or completion of the project is June of this year. Now, whether we'll meet the deadline or not, we've got problems in construction because of the kind of weather we're having now. The trend number two is a much larger project. It's 163 units at $2 million. And we are in hopes that we can get the balance out of two as a result of our experiences in one. We are in the process now of developing a management team. On number one, we went, we hired agents. So we're using a housing agent to take care of our rents and the upkeep of the building. Because we are really satisfied with it, we had the feeling that we could take it on as a self-management project and do it well with self-management as the agency is doing, managing for us. And so we have selected Frank Cummins, who is now the Secretary of Church Extension for the Avian Church, who has an office in St. Louis, as sort of the coordinator and controller and to develop an auto management team. He will not be on salary, but he will oversee the team. He will see that we have a rent collector, we will have a bookkeeper secretary, and we will have an on-the-job manager for the project. We feel like that if we're managing ourselves, whatever income there is, it will be helpful to our project, as well as give us an opportunity to train people, indigenous people, how to be managers and how to take on this kind of responsibility. One of the new things I think we've said to our new management team is that in the previous case we have had to find out how many members of a family, the income, and all of these other matters which make them eligible for being tenants in the building, is that we, in order to improve the general appearance of the property and to ensure that care, that doesn't apply, and we get all the other information, the agent must go to the home which is now being occupied by the person who has made application to see how they're living there, see how they treat the property they now, you know, rent. And unless they give some real assurance that they're going to live under these new kind of standards that we're going to offer them, then they will not be allowed to move into the property. Social services seems to be a very important part of now in helping people to learn how to live in these projects. People of low-income families need to be troubled, need to be assisted, need some help and the care of property. Now, I sort of jumped over a whole other thing. I didn't tell you how we, you know, what problems we had when we started. I didn't tell you how we put this package together, and maybe I should say some of these things. But maybe I was done. I'll let you know, get everything in the hopper, and we could sort of answer questions. Might be more direct.
All right, this is remarkable respect.
Just
only 7 minutes. Do you want to ask me questions about this now?
I think the project is very distinct because we're talking about it.
All right, let's take a few minutes for questions here. You do not interact with the car.
When you go to visit these homes, see whether what kind of care they're doing, what protection they have been living in. They which has been taking a good care of where they have been living. Is there something about it? Did that just automatically move them off?
No, I don't think it automatically moved them out. I think that we say to them at that point, you know, let's lay on the line. You know, you haven't taken good care of what you have. You want better living. You want better housing. We're going to continue to get better housing, but we want you to really follow the kind of regulation and the kind of help that we want to provide so that you can sort of upgrade your status. Please remember we haven't done this yet because the project is under construction. But our intentions are to form some social services for the people. You know, some class on home economics, on the general care, on building, this sort of thing, so that they can be assisted. We've had some suits and lawsuits already. real problems that the church faces. I think we lied out of part of it. But we had the pastor who was in the church, Philip Project, who was too involved with the tenant, so that you had a situation there where the church acted not as a business area, but acted almost completely as a welfare area. The church has to show compassion and all this sort of thing, but it has to have some stability, it has to have some sense of business. And you can't let people stay in because they say, my husband, just doesn't have any way to pay. Now, after a certain period of time, you better do something about it. So while we permitted an agency to collect the rents and to take care of the upkeep of the building, our Augustine pastor was running in conflict with it. He would say to a tenant, "Look, you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to do this." And of course, the manager had no more of this and was catching the devil because the pastor was on the board of directors, and the pressure was there. We've learned that if we're going to run a housing program, we're going to manage housing, the management has to be given completely in the hands of the management team. The board of directors has to stay out of it. If they say anything, that question must be raised at a board of directors meeting and not between the tenants, sort of a shield between the tenants and the agent. His relationship with Project was that, he was a part of a dream, and that his church, sits right in the heart of the project. And there are three churches involved in our project, you see. Two of us, the churches are in the inner city, or in St. Louis proper. And the third church, St. Luke, is in Elmwood Park. So it's right next to the project, so that whatever problems came, the pastor was fielding them. He was catching the ball instead of letting the ball go where it should have gone. And we got some particular situations. We have a guy who owes, $1,200 worth of rent. Yeah. It will never be able to collect. He lives out in Washington. Well, I'm not sure what you mean by spiritual responsibility other than we're concerned about their well-being. We have no particular concern as to which congregation they belong to. This is not our job at all. We can belong to any congregation they want to belong to. But we are concerned that the people who live in the project, people who every chance for a decent kind of life. This is, I think, all we're interested in. There's no basic pastoral responsibility to them other than that of humanity, but not as AME necessarily.
I'm sure when the person comes to AME, they'll be in your truck.
Right.
How does $2 million project know? Did you have to get some kind of seed money together?
This was the right thing, like I said, I didn't mention briefly. Elmwood Park happens to be an urban renewal area, and that was to our advantage. And the land clearance people in Elmwood Park were anxious to see some development done in the area. Now, after number one was finished, we became aware of the fact that there was a because friend number one had been developed by the AME Church, we sort of got put together, so we kind of made a, you know, sort of had a marriage. And we needed a developer, you know, somebody to put up some money. He needed somebody to sponsor the project. I have to admit that it only has been the best kind of marriage for us, because I think it would have been far better if we could have had a sponsor and then, you know, a sponsor has gone out and tried to find a developer who was going to go along with us and put the necessary money out. Because after all, the contract, you know, the money is there, because he is not only the contractor, he's also the architect in the project, and so whatever money is there will be in his hands. But we had some problems with him because of the fact that he did put up the money, and we really didn't invite him in. We thought that we sat down together and said, well, you need us and I need you, so you know, let's go. We were anxious to get a job done, and so we went on. We found that we went through a great number of painful experiences, and at one time I thought we were going to really lose the project because of the belligerence of our contract and architect with the MHA people downtown. We had some hot days, and Mike Gallagher office. But we got started. I think he underbid the project. I think he could have got more money out of it. So, but we haven't had to put up any seed money. He's doing it. It's a prefab, number two here. Foundation, of course, support by the team here. And then the building, the project, the building, the framework, and everything. And Sedalia, and moving it to. No seed money was necessary. It hasn't cost us really any money. And we were lucky because I don't know where we would have gotten seed money.
All right. Hansel, you want to take over that 20 minutes? Let's hear how you got started on your money.
Why don't you sit down?
Yeah,
I'm going to run around and on. That one is strong. Sit down here. Front my shoulder. Now, my own problem with this, I'm going to be very honest with you, man, is strongly theological. And I'm going to say some things that may be offensive to some of you brethren, but I'm going to be honest with you. I built a church, a medium-sized church in the city of Washington, D.C. And, of course, it was a tremendous experience in the church, but when I built this church, I lacked in my ministry what I consider respectability. I built another church, a shell of the Michigan, out in the very heart of the industrial area of Detroit, River Rouge. And I did this job, and I honestly say to you that I had a certain sense of a lack of respectability for my ministry. And it seems as though that this lack of respectability resulted in a kind of phenomenon that resulted in my exposure to a man by the name of Harvey Cox. These old theologians to me were saying nothing, and the theological orientation they had was supra and extra mundane and a lot of junk that to me meant nothing. I like to read Buffalo Blank and all that bull, you know, and 1525 and all of that. But to me, on Sunday morning, we met, we sang and prayed, and hugged each other, shook hands, and went home. And this, to me, lacked a meaningful respectability. And by some act of divinity, there came on the scene men like Gibson Winters, John H. Robinson, Harvey Cox, the men who had a new approach to the whole meaning of the sacred and the secular. And it seems as though that when this came along, I was caught up at the Urban Training Center in Chicago. And what they were saying, what they were doing, made sense to me, a heck of a lot of sense. Here we have the sacred on Sunday, We have Jesus on the altar on Monday, we leave him, then he stays there until the following Sunday. And so we in St. Louis came here with the understanding that St. James Church, a middle class, sophisticated Negro church that exists, and a sea of squalor, was standing there on the corner with a big, ugly monstrosity across the street. And these middle class, sophisticated Negroes would drive their Cadillacs and Buicks and wrap their necks in mink and not see the ugliness and the squalor of this ghetto. Now, I must be honest with you, brethren, that my first look at this building across the street was fairly from the point of real estate. That I understood they had someone in the bank to build a $250,000 educational building that they had talked about for many years. And I could not really, with my own sense of real estate values, reconcile putting $250,000 with a junk house like that on your front doorstep. But in the process, in dealing with this thing, I began to also explore different kinds of problems that existed that would help me get rid of that dump, and also accomplish something in terms of my ministry. I had a twofold purpose. That was to get rid of the dump, and also to involve the church in a significant way. And so I took out, and I shared them because time is permitted. But the first motivation I had was to do good. And I met a man in FHA who was a black man who I thought had some integrity and some intelligence, and I found I didn't have much of either. Well, this man led me to Park Lockwood in purchasing two pieces of land. Here's an old cottage, the ugly monstrosity, and here is an apartment building. This man told me what the payroll is, that he had a conversation and approval by the chief underwriter at FHA where this man might gather. So he told me he paid this for this old pool building, $65,000, for this one to John. And he told me to pay another $29,000 for this. Now, this piece of property here was owned by a Baptist church. And the Baptist preacher that owned this building had sunk about $25,000 to make a hotel. And he lost his property. It went bankrupt. So I bought it from the $5,000. And this was $29,000. Now, then when I negotiated the Baptist property, this Baptist preacher was a very slick lawyer. The slick lawyer told him he could file a redemption petition and save his equity. So this man filed his redemption petition in the courts, which stopped the consummation of the sale. And in the meanwhile, this man from FHA is telling me he wants to push on. FHA wants this nursing home. And go and talk to this man and see how much money he will take to extricate us from this legal law. I wanted this preacher, he said he wanted $10,000, and you can't be funny. And so finally, we got down to $7,000. So then we had to pay $65,000, $7,000, $29,000, and finally about $3,000 in taxes. This man ended up paying. So he ended up paying approximately around $101,000, $102,000. We took from the treasury of the church cash about $32,000 to buy all this. Now, happy that it's going well. And when we put the phone application, we got the response from FHA, Mr. Valenis, a good friend, Mike Gallagher. It was a very tough nut to deal with. I like Mike. He's a tough nut. He's a typical realist, you know, bureaucrat. He looks like a bureaucrat for a walk down the street. And he's a bureaucrat. But the main thing was that when the reply came to us, simply this, that this project is not easy. We cannot justify building a nursing home on that site. The economics, what have you, don't suggest this. But then this man in the FHA office told me, oh, don't take that, that's just a routine letter. What you do, you go and get a conference in Washington. Go to Washington with your architect and with your lawyer and present your case. So we went to Washington, and all of us got together, you know, papers, and
$10 for First Liberty National. That's one father. Man, well, that's interesting. You have a very simple problem now. Go back to St. Louis, make a survey, put a chair out of there, and then have to sign and show it to the local office to find enough Negroes who can pay you $10. My office is easy. I have them on the airplane, and you'll grab my survey sheets, start knocking the door to door. Finally, the son of the Negroes said, no income. Many had $40 a month, and most of them ran from 80 to 110. You see the problem. So the nursing home went down the drain. And of course, I sent in to this man that they came about Gilbert, giving him a grand of half of this old block, you know. So what I did then, I almost committed suicide. I couldn't sleep, I had insomnia, I had all kinds of frustration, moments of great depression. And when even the congregation began to understand that $32,000 is gone. And that's it. All right? I met a man, this little meat man, a man at lunch with him named Calloway. Calloway is a black man for Congress, and he was saying, you know, it's unfortunate. I think we're going to want to miss this man. That he didn't meet Mr. Klein, who is our consulting council pastor at Freedom South Grand. And so immediately I made an appointment to see Mr. Klein, the heavens over that morning, that Monday morning, being fairly, you know. And I went to Mr. Klein with my paper. The man stopped me and said, don't waste more time. It's a good thing he's in the nursing home business because of this problem, that problem. So what we will do, we will do what we call a 202. Now, a 202 deal is a housing project for middle-class Negroes, middle-class whites. And the rents range from $25 to $95 per month. We got the site approval, and I shall tell you, I just want to tell you what's involved in the site approval. And finally got the site approved, and they approved of this application for the 202. Would have been housing for middle class Negroes, low middle class Negroes. About the time we were preparing to submit the formal application, I received a call from Mr. Klein's office, somebody to come immediately. I went down and he had Mr. Dayton. And Mr. Dayton was there, Mr. Klein and I met, and they came up with a new idea of Turnkey 2. Turnkey 2 is perhaps the most recent approach to public housing. And Turnkey 2 is the kind of program that allows for a higher ceiling of economics, unlike what Anderson talked about. An old Turnkey deal started in Washington, D.C. I met the man who began it, a man named Joseph Burstein, who was a lawyer. And Burstein saw a building being built in Washington for high middle class white people, very beautiful building. I went through the building on the tour once. And he conceived the idea that we would buy this building from the general contractor their days off. During their days off, a part of that day, they will give their free time. Now, we also have in this medical clinic a for diet. We found out from studying in Washington that the number one malady old people have is the malady of foot trouble. This is interesting. Corn, onions, what happens? So we have a podiatrist who signs under saying he will come and serve all the people free. Now, we also are concerned about different kinds of therapies. One is oxygen grafts. We have provided that. We don't pay for the bill. The necessary ovens for eating and what have you. Also, a little room that we will call the wood workshop, where men can go in there and learn to do things with their hands. We also are planning to have a little super rec, where we can operate in a very minimum state of cost. We will provide them with toilet articles and bread and milk and cream and sugar and coffee, little things that they can pick up. Now, this whole thing, turnkey to, is a different approach in that it involves the grassroots, the people of the community, such as St. James Church, having the knowledge and awareness of the needs of the people in the community. But it also allows, with this, certain amenities. There's a book you ought to read sometimes by Charles Abram, New Frontiers in Housing. And the whole concept of housing one time when these programs began for this provider was anything is good enough for the poor. The poor man who is poor has no choices, no options. Give him anything. Let him be glad. And so in turnkey to the new book that has really influenced, I think, HUD, is a book called New Frontiers in Housing by Charles Abram, in which he talks about that the poor must have some options. Now, in the James House, we have 50% showers and 50% tubs. The person coming in may have the choice for medicinal purposes, some people need the soap. They authorize a certain therapeutic value in hot water, and of course, that business is in mind also. Just getting up to hot water makes you feel that, you know, it would be better. Now, in a nutshell, this is the whole program of turnkey two. The whole idea is that you bureaucracy will not dictate the architectural and functional aspects of housing, but that the people at the grassroots will have some say about this. Now, this is a very painful thing. I've touched every base in City St. Louis. From the mayor's office to the board of aldermen, from the board of aldermen to the board of adjustment, and finally in the courts. This is true. I go to court for about 7 or 8 weeks in succession. Building department took me one time, 32, I guess you'd call them bills of complaints to the building department. Go down, all the judge and tell the judge why this big ugly thing was not boarded up. Was a menace to the community. The other time, of course, I said, may it please his honor to give me more grace, they spend the time long enough that I can get the building department and the building torn down. Now, in this program, there are three things that seem very significant about this turnkey to. You have to have what we call, they call, the letter of intent. And you get your preliminary drawings, you go to Fort Worth, you look at them, they tell you what they think about them. Then they give you the green light to go to the next step, which consists of the submission of more detailed drawings. Now, if they are impressed with detailed drawings and that you know what you're doing, they then issue the letter of intent. Now, when you've got the letter of intent, you've got the government pretty well tied up. In this instance, when they issue the letter of intent to St. James Church, the federal government committed itself to pay St. James Church $118,000 for the site. Now, this $118,000 was a very difficult thing. First of all, the real estate banks were probably only worth $60,000. Two of them. And I had to get on the phone and beg and pray and cry and moan and groan to convince Fort Worth that this church in good intent has spent $118,000 and that we should not have to suffer. And of course, the man said, when I do all your 35 copies, your closing costs, tax bills, your plumbing bills,
Now, then, the next thing was, I could get an architect to do all this work. This is a lot of work. So the Levin Pen said that we will give Schwartz and Van Hoken $78,000 for what they've done, those blueprints, all the surveys for the different engineering costs. And then finally, as the judge had got on me so many times, and that I found out in court Monday night, Monday out. Finally, I get on the phone one day and called over. I said, listen, Mr. Coker, Cooper Coker was a man from the black man, very interesting. And I said, of course, you're going to have to amend the letter of intent. You're going to have to give me the assurance and guarantee of the cost to tear this building down. And so then we would have done this before. We only do two things. That's the land and architect fees. So I kept on talking to this man. One morning, I almost got raped in the building. This is a fact. Now that was about to go to jail, you know? And well, this is true. So finally, the man called me one of the days and said, what you do? You get the general contractor to find out what it will cost to tear it down. So one man came in with $40,000 to tear it down. Outdoor construction, demolition engineering company. And finally, we got a deal for $33,500. They issued a letter of intent, which meant then that if the deal went down, the St. James Church would get $118,000, Schwartz and Van Hoken would get his $78,000, and the demolition man would get his. Now, in the final consummation of this deal, the federal government said that we will allow $2,600,000 to build this building. And when we get the final blueprints, and our engineers have approved of it, then we will take the final working drawings and send the set to Denver, Colorado, and a set to Madison, Wisconsin. And they will tell us how much this building is worth. This is what they call dollar value. For example, how would the federal government list it worth $2,600,000? It is worth $1,500,000. Now, the preliminary drawings, Denver's building would be worth $2,400,000. And Madison, Wisconsin said $2,500,000. Now, the midpoint then becomes the final price, which would be $2,450,000. Now, if we were able to negotiate, if they said the final figure is $2,100,000, we said, no, we can't go for that. We must have $2,100,000. We could negotiate. Then the federal government pays St. James for $18,000, pays Washington Van Hoen for $78,000, pays the demolition man $32,500. We're out of the federal government comes in, takes the plans, the surveys, and like I said, this is very important, that this whole thing is contingent on the fact that you get the property rezoned. And I had a sword at the time getting that. That's no easy thing, but this piece of property zoned. And then to go before the Board of Adjustment to get them to make amendments for parking is not easy. But all of this falls through then if you don't get your zoning and meet the state and city requirements. So now we have to find out where the papers are in Fort Worth, they're being checked out of Madison and Denver. Then when you take the church is safe on there, and you're about 90% demolished on the building.
Oh, yes,
all that. Well, the bell is rung. If you want to ask him an individual question, though, I thank you.
Thank you.